From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the producer Rita Coburn-Wack first approached Maya Angelou about making a documentary of her life, Angelou gave her a look. This was before she said anything, before she agreed to be part of it, which she did. Coburn-Wack says the look she gave said something like, "Do you know what you're asking?" And she really didn't know, at first, what she was asking. I mean, she knew what most of us know about Angelou's public persona, her activism, her writing, but there was a lot she didn't know. Angelou agreed to dredge up the painful stories of her childhood, the stories of grief and passion, her love affairs, and her art, the poems, her music, her dancing. Today in the program, we're talking about that documentary. It's called Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back in 2012, there were at least two people thinking about doing a documentary of the poet and activist Maya Angelou, Bob Hercules and Rita Coburn-Wack. But both of them were thinking the same thing. Surely someone already had done a documentary of her life. After all, Angelou was a groundbreaking poet, a fearless and candid writer whose life intersected with so much American history. She endured an upbringing in the Jim Crow South and sexual abuse. She was present and engaged as the civil rights movement took hold in 1960. Her book, Tell Me Why the Caged Bird Sings, in 1969, was a landmark of brutal honesty. The poem she read at the inauguration of Bill Clinton was unforgettable still. In 2012, there was no documentary. Well, Coburn, Mack, and Hercules have remedied that, and their documentary is part of this year's Sundance Film Festival. So we're live in Park City today at the studios of community radio station KPCW talking about the film. It's called Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. Joining us is Rita Coburn-Wack, a radio and television producer. She directed Maya Angelou's radio show for Oprah Radio. She's co-director of the documentary. And Rita Coburn-Wack, welcome to you. Thanks for being with
us.
Thanks
for having us. Wonderful.
Bob Hercules co-directs the film. His other work includes Joffrey, Mavericks of American Dance, and Bill T. Jones, A Good Man, which aired on the PBS series American Masters. And Bob Hercules, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Maya Angelou and Still I Rise premieres Tuesday at the festival. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Rita Coburn-Wack, let's start with you, because I've heard you say this. I want you to tell the story of your first meeting with Maya, because it's a good one. It seems like there are a lot of good stories related here, but when you first met her?
I first met her as interviewing her for a public radio station, WBEZ Chicago, where I both did a number of radio shows. And as I interviewed her, I went to her hotel with my producer, Tashima Walker. So Tashima and I went to the Ambassador East, which is where Maya Angelou would stay. I had reread all of her works up until that point because being a writer and being an avid reader and interviewing mostly female writers for the WBEZ program, I really wanted to be prepared. So I had five books and stickies and all the rest of that. And we were spread out in the Ambassador East. And she came in and I said to her, introduce myself. And she noted the books and everything. And I said to her, we have 45 minutes and we're going to. And she said, "No, dear, we do not. We have a half an hour." And I thought, how am I going to make an hour-long program out of a half an hour interview? And then she said, "But for the entire time, I will be with you." And that's the lesson that I learned from that interview. The entire time she was engaged, she sang, she did poetry, and there was a presence there. And when the interview was over, which she did actually spend more than a half an hour with me, she put her hand on mine and said, "I'll see you, dear." And I thought, I'm going to see her again. But it was a very wonderful interview and a very wonderful meeting for someone that I had often read and wanted to meet. So it was engaging.
You know, the other thing I think I learned from that story, because I've read an example of that where you mentioned it, was that on one hand, yes, she was present, mm-hmm. but she also spoke her mind. She was very mm-hmm. direct with you, right?
Yes.
We have a half an hour, and she was. That, I wonder if that could be a little intimidating. But she just,
I think it is intimidating, yeah. And I think that she can be intimidating, but I think it's out of a hard-won position yeah. in life, and she was constantly teaching. And so my mother, who's 93, and Dr. Angelo would say when I would mention the ages when she was alive, she would say, oh, I'm a teenager, because my mother was older than she. And one of the things that I think a lot of women from that era, and her in particular, black women, they knew they had lived through history. They knew that they didn't have as much time as they had spent. And they would put you in your place in a second. And it was out of love, but yeah. it was also out of the economy of time. And so that's who she was yeah. all the time that I knew her. And Bob can attest to this, too. If you mm-hmm. were in her presence, mm-hmm. you knew your place.
Yeah.
Always.
Would you talk about that, Bob Hercules, the first time you met her? Were you terrified?
I wasn't terrified. I met her in the late 90s. I had done a sponsored project for Prevent Child Abuse America, and we wanted to get somebody to narrate the film, and among other people, Maya Angelou's name came up, and I was always a fan. I had read her book, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, in college, and it always struck me. It was an amazing book. It was, for me, you know, living a somewhat, it was an amazing revelation to read that book and to realize in words that I hadn't really read anybody else, especially a black woman, describe the situation she grew up in the Deep South, the Jim Crow South, the vicious racism, the way she did it, and the way she overcame that, though, with grace.
Yeah.
That's what amazed me. So I was always impressed with her. So then we got to this point of wanting to hire somebody to do this voiceover, and I might have been the person who suggested Maya Angelou. It seemed difficult, but we reached her. She agreed to do it. I flew down to Winston-Salem, where she lived, and it was phenomenal. I just, you know, it was just a great experience to meet her. Her voice has that amazing resonance.
No doubt.
You think about when she gave the inauguration poem, and just that beautiful, commanding voice. And she did a wonderful job. And I got my picture taken with her. And the picture is important because that's what led me to Rita, in a sense, that years and years later, my assistant was looking at that photo on my desk of me and Maya Angelou. And she asked me about it, and I started telling her the story, you know. Then all of a sudden, a light went off in my head. And I said, Alex, I don't recall anybody ever having made a documentary about Maya Angelou, but I must be crazy. It's got to have been done, yeah. right? It's Maya Angelou. So we did a search in IMDb and Google and everything we could think of, and nothing came up. And I was like, whoa, that is so weird.
Yeah.
How could that be? So I'll make a long story short. A mutual friend of ours introduced us, and Rita had been thinking along the same lines. And obviously Rita knew Dr. Angelou, had her trust, which was crucial. And we came together, and it happened. Other people had wanted to make that film, many, many people. But I guess we must have hit the right time, and Rita was the right trusted person.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Everything came together. It was beautiful.
I want to come back to just how personal this project may have been for you, Rita. It seems like it was a personal project in some level, probably for both of you, in terms of your interactions with her. Let's talk about Maya Angelou's life, her parents. Her father, as she mentions in the documentary, came back from World War I, much too grand for the color of his skin.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother, bright and courageous, and would you talk about her parents and what kind of influence they had on the making of the person she became?
I think that one thing that we find in history and in anyone's personal history, your parents are one person when you're a child. They're another person when you're an adolescent. They're another person when you're an adult. So it's very important for us to be able to research through audio even the different years in which she spoke about her parents, because as she got older, she spoke very much less about her father and more about the courage of her mother. But in knowing her, what I found out was that she had a very forgiving spirit, but she felt very much slighted by both of them in her early years.
Yeah.
She felt that their relationship was so volatile. They were young people trying to get together in a very racist era. So if you have a young black man that goes away to the war, and while he could be killed, he's got more freedom than he had in the Jim Crow South. So he may carry a weapon. He has camaraderie. Yeah. He may have a sense of leadership. And in his particular case, he also had, he learned French. He learned things. And he saw himself as someone who could walk erect in the society. Yeah. And to come back to the Jim Crow South was difficult. Meanwhile, you have this very beautiful young woman, and she's also beginning to sense that her beauty and that her ability to be such a strong person, given the family she grew up in. She grew up in a very rough family.
Yeah.
And so they were, as Guy Johnson, her son, writes in his book, cut and shoot Negroes. I mean, they were gangsters for the most part. And she was a fighter. She was often the person in the bar, and her father would say, you go get that person. And she'd level someone, and her brothers would back her up. So this was a very rough woman, a very beautiful woman, a very confident woman. And then she gets together with a man who speaks French, and he wants to tame her. And their relationship does not work out. And Maya Angelou is born into that relationship.
Yeah. Neither, volatile is how she describes it.
She describes it as that. And neither one of them had time for children. They had children, but they didn't have time for that.
Which gets us to stamps in Arkansas. I want to talk about this. Her parents basically send her to stamps to mm-hmm. live with her grandmother.
That's right.
And we'll talk about the influence of her, with profound influence of her grandmother on the way she saw the world. But there's this moment. It's interesting. You found this. There's this interview she did with Bill Moyers back in 1982, and we see clips from that. And she is returning to stamps in this. This was in the 1980s, 1982, I think it was.
Yeah, it was 82.
After 30 years. She goes back to stamps, and she's driving along. So you'll hear her driving along, and then we'll also hear her she'll make reference to it. But we hear her reading from her reflections on stamps, what the place was like, and this sense of rejection that she felt because her parents sent her away. Here's a moment from the documentary.
In my memory, stamps is a place of light, shadow, sounds, and entrancing odors. The yellowish acid of the ponds and rivers. The deep pots of greens cooking for hours with smoked or cured pork. And above all, the atmosphere was pressed down with the smell of old fears.
Is that all the size of the bridge? I was terribly hurt in this town and vastly loved.
Isn't that interesting? Both of those things, hurt and loved at the same time. That did seem to represent exactly what that was about, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, all the agony, all the pain, but also all the joy. It seems like in some ways kind of a metaphor for her life, both of those conflicting things going on.
And for many of our lives, but yeah, I mean, her grandmother was an incredible influence and wrapped her arms around her and carried her through this experience. And it was tremendous love, but also, as she said, it was tremendously difficult to live in that town. There was, you know, it was a very divided town, white versus black, very racist, terrible. You know, so it had this dichotomy, basically, which was I think, typical of her life in some ways. But she was, like I said earlier, I think the thing to admire about her is she rose above that, those challenges, and moved forward.
Yeah.
And that's amazing to me.
Rita Kilburn-Weck, that her grandmother, one thing that Maya mentions in the film is that almost the moment she arrives in Stamps, her mother started teaching her to read.
Her grandmother.
Forgive me, her grandmother, yes.
Well, one of the things that happened in Black culture during that time, and you'll find it in different literature, and you'll also find it, I found it in my family. There was something that you were taught. While her grandmother wrapped her arms around her figuratively, you will hear Maya Angelou say that she never hugged her. She never touched her that way because you were in a society where you had to teach children not to trust a lot of things. Because if you became too warm, too cuddly, and you had to face racism, you had to be able to tell someone to do something, hide from the Klan now, go here, go there, and they had to do it. So you could not do the kind of embraces that we have right now. Mother Henderson was a very stoic woman, and she was tall like Maya Angelou, and she was not a poor person. She was an entrepreneur. She started off with meat pies to the workers, and then she built a store. And so they had more than many blacks. They had a country store. They also owned land. And Mother Henderson was not a person that you could pay next week. In that sense, she made sure that she kept the books right and that she continued to buy land. And so she was that person, as well as a person who took her religion very seriously, yeah. Took her faith in God, and she taught that. Very much different than Vivian Baxter, the mother who grew up with the rough and tumbly cut and shoot Negroes, and now you have a person who brings the minister over for dinner. And so that was the South that she grew up in. And I think when you say that wonderful line, that I was terribly hurt here and vastly loved. Yeah. I think her pain came from inside of the family as well as the racism outside. And I think the love came from knowing that this woman had pretty much saved her.
There's this terrific moment where she, in this trip she takes back to Stamps, where she's talking to a congregation, a church congregation, and she's telling them this story of when she was on tour with Porgy and Bess in, I guess it was in Europe, mm-hmm. And she was asked, was this in Cairo? Where was this?
No, that was in Europe.
Was this in Europe? Okay.
Yeah.
So this moment where she's asked to sing an aria, and she doesn't know what an aria is. She doesn't know quite. It's the Russian conductor, Alexander Smolens, who says, you know, can you sing an aria? And she says, I can't really come up with one. But he says, surely you know a spiritual. And she knew tons of spirituals. And she tells the story of singing this spiritual. And then, as we'll hear in this moment from the film, she also talks to them about what this meant to her and what Stamps did for her, that brought her. And this is, I think, so interesting because you get a sense how important the experience of church, of God, mm-hmm. was for her. Let's play that moment from the film.
And I just grinned and thought about Stamps, Arkansas, where from the time I was 3, Mama took me to church on Sunday. Then on Monday evening, we went to missionary meeting, Tuesday evening usher board meeting, Wednesday evening prayer meeting, Thursday evening choir practice. We went to church all the time. And at all those meetings, we sang. So I told the man, yes, I know a spiritual. So I stood on the stage alone and sang, I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I'm lost in this wide world alone. I sang her song. And when I finished, 4,500 Arabs jumped up and hit the floor and started to shout, Walai lazim ala walai. And I looked stage right at the wings where the singers had sung. And they were looking at me like, so I said, I'm sorry. I mean, you sang Puccini and Bach and Beethoven and Haydn. And I sang what
W.B. Du Bois called the Sorrow Songs.
Songs written not by free and easy people, not by a leisure class. Songs written from the heart, written with their blood, written with the whips and the lash on their back. When I sung these songs, the people couldn't stop screaming. Then I began to think, ah, I see. Now I see. When the people were passing out the big packets of land and money, my people had none of that to give me. But what they gave me, look at what they gave me. My Lord, look at what they gave me. It opens doors for me all over the world.
Such a great moment.
It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
Yeah.
Because we cut back and forth between her present day interview, back into the church, back and forth, and she tells it so powerfully. It's such a great story.
And she comes in right on the same key.
I know.
From
it's
82.
Isn't that amazing?
With that song.
She is amazing.
And the song is, in the black church, it's a long meter hymn, as opposed to the transition from spiritual and long meter hymn before you even got to gospel. In musicology has a meaning in there so that you stretch out those notes, and that could fall into a call and response or something called Dr. Watts when there's moans. And so that whole coming back to stamps, when you see the picture of the people there, there's some ways as if time hasn't moved. And if we visited the raw tapes and many of the things that happened in stamps, I remember her, which is not in the film, her recalling that if you came from stamps, you were going to be a survivor, that it was a hard place to live. So you're right. It taught her a lot. It taught her what was able to take her into the Arab community and into across the world.
You know, you mentioned a moment ago your first conversation with her, that she and she was reciting poetry and she was singing. Did everyone who had the great opportunity to interview Maya Angelou, did they get favored with a song? Did she sing a lot in those conversations?
She sang a lot. I don't think everyone got that, but she did sing a lot. And singing and music was always important to her throughout her life. It connected her to her grandmother because her grandmother sang at church every Sunday. And she would sing the same song. And people would get wound up, as she would say. Some woman would take her purse and wind it up and let it go in the air because of the emphasis on the music and the way that it moved her in terms of faith. But all her life, music is a character with her.
She started, I think, our first interview with a song. Very first thing. Just wonderful.
What a gift.
Mm-hmm.
Rita Colburn-Wack and Bob Hercules, co-directors of Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. The film premieres next Tuesday with additional screenings throughout the week. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We should also mention that this fall, the film is going to be seen on the PBS series American Masters. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the poet and activist Maya Angelou. And you would think there would have been a documentary of Angelou before now, but the film premiering at the Sundance Film Festival this year is the first. We're in Park City today talking with the filmmakers. Rita Colburn-Wack is with us and Bob Hercules. They wanted to make a film, a documentary, that wasn't just a chronicle of her life, but a story of who she was and how she loved. The film is called Maya Angelou and Still I Rise, and we'll give you details about some of the screenings. The film's going to be premiering on the PBS series American Masters in the fall. Let's talk about this moment, extraordinary moment. Her father takes her back to St. Louis to see her mother. Her parents had, as she puts it in the film, agreed to disagree, and they break up. And it's an entirely different life from the South, obviously. It's an entirely different life from the sort of constant, the church upbringing. It's her grandmother's, as you mentioned, Rita, completely different from her grandmother's, completely different from her mother. And she is raped when she's seven. Would you talk a little bit about this? She relates the story, but she talks about how her seven-year-old, this man who raped her, was killed. Mm-hmm. Kicked to death, they think. And as she puts it, her seven-year-old logic told her that she had killed the man, that her words had killed the man. And she stopped speaking. Would you talk about that? She stopped speaking for 5 years.
I think that we go back to 1928 when she was born and raped at 1935 in this kind of environment where I think she writes that it was hard to believe that gambling and a lot of the other, let's call it the sporting life, prostitution things that she would see were against the law because they were so common. So coming from that into that whole era is culture shock as it is. And then being back with a mother, and obviously every girl wants their mother, and yet the mother's lifestyle is such that she has no real place to put that. And so being raped by the mother's boyfriend, in one of the interviews that we found later, she said, "I'm not saying that this as it's an excuse, but this man was intoxicated with my mother. And in his inability to have her when he wanted her, I believe he raped me," because we know rape is an act of violence. And as that happened, you have to think that here was this seven-year-old who, even at that point, had it in her mind that as horrible as rape was, if this person was killed because of her voice, she wouldn't want anybody else to die. Mm. And that is a forgiving, in a sense, spirit. And that is a very highly intellectual spirit to say, "I don't want to kill people. As bad as this is, I don't want to kill anybody else. This could kill my brother. If I speak, I could kill people with my voice." And I'm sure you don't have anybody coming in with the psychologist. This is something that you had to then, everybody had to learn how to deal with a little girl who had been violated in this way, what to do.
It seems like forgiveness is almost a theme in her life, mm-hmm. because she says that there are a number of times when she talks about not just the idea of forgiving others, but almost more importantly, forgiving herself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she says that many times when we filmed her at different events and throughout her life. She always talked about she would advocate forgiveness, but also she would advocate, and I will also forgive myself.
Yeah.
Which really, when you think about it, I actually made a film about forgiveness 10 years ago, and so I've thought a lot about it.
With Helen Whitney? Was this another one?
It was called Forgiving Dr. Mengele.
Wow.
And so I've thought a lot about this, but I think what she's getting at is to truly forgive, you first of all have to take the step of forgiving yourself, and then whatever else you need to do.
Yeah.
So I think she got that right. I mean, she's, like Rita said, she thought an amazing ability to think these things through, even at such a young age. It's amazing, though, when you think that she didn't speak for years, and then you think about her voice being one of the most powerful voices in American culture. The irony of that is stunning.
As she puts it, her parents or her mother was weary of this little girl who was basically mute, and she gets sent back to stamps.
And it's rejection here, again.
Rejection again. I kept thinking about that.
Yeah.
And she thought she had to stop talking, but she could listen. I mean, all the long she's observing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, there's this miracle of a woman named Mrs. Flowers who lives in stamps. And she tells this story of this woman who would read her poetry. Let's play another moment from the film Maya Angelou and Still I Rise.
There was a lady in town, Mrs. Flowers, and she would take me to her house about twice a year. She made lemonade and tea cookies, big cookies like that in the South, delicious. And she'd serve me, and she knew I didn't speak, and she'd read one of the poets to me. She'd done this with me for 3 or 4 years. And finally, I was at her house one day, and she said, "Maya, you don't like poetry." "Oh," I said, "yes, ma'am." She wouldn't even pick up my
my tablet, she wouldn't look at it. And then she pointed at me. And she was a grand and genteel lady. She said, "You'll never like it until you speak it, until you feel it come across your tongue, over your teeth, through your lips. You will never like it." So finally, I went under the house where there used to be chickens and the dirt was soft like powder. And I tried poetry.
That moment when she talks about how she read everything she could get her hands on. And this was the thing that was really striking to me, and it gave me maybe some insight into the way her mind worked. She talked about memorizing Shakespeare plays, Longfellow, Balzac, Poe.
Right.
As she put it, when I decided to speak, I had a lot to say. Could you ever identify whether she had like a photographic memory? I mean, I'm guessing when you would talk to her, she would recall these spirituals and these poems and these moments. I mean, her mind was pretty remarkable.
I think she's one of those people, a mind that's much more developed than the rest of us. I think their recall is amazing. And also when she was doing the interviews with us, she had an amazing ability to put herself back in that time frame and back in that place and just almost relive it, sometimes painfully. So she is very unusual in that sense of having that recall. I've rarely met anybody who could remember things like that in such detail.
I think that when you look at education in the South at that time, there was a great need to assimilate. Mm. And in that assimilation, there was, so for instance, you had the Fisk singers. The Fisk imitated classical music. And so the way that young people were taught during that time, they had to memorize poetry. That was one of the things that you did. If you were so, there was even Latin at points taught because this is the kind of ancient teaching. And then the Bible was taught. And so if you're looking at Proverbs and you're looking at Song of Solomon and you're looking at poetry in that classic sense, Guy de Maupassant and Shakespeare, when you learn those works, you learn them by memorizing them and memorizing cadence along with them. And so that builds a great memory. And for people that were educated in that time, she calls Mrs. Flowers a genteel woman who only invited her up twice a year. Again, there was their own little black elite that happened. There was a word that I noticed from my aunts. You had to carry yourself with a certain comportment. And so these things were important, even though there was this barbaric sense of racism and classism that was going on. Education was very serious, and it was a classic education. So if for 5 years you're not speaking, but you're reading all of these works, which is another thing that James Baldwin did.
Yeah.
These are self-taught people. So Maya Angelou never had a degree from any university except for an honorary degree. But from that time period, if you're reading those kind of works between the ages of 7 and 13, then you would have to be highly self-educated.
You know, there's this moment from some talk show in the 1980s or 90s or something like that when a young girl stands to ask her a question. I want to play this moment because it's such a startling moment. I was thinking about you, Rita, and your first encounter with her, how she was direct with you but also present. Let me play this moment. This is some television talk show, and this young African-American girl stands to address Maya Angelou.
Kim, you had a question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask Maya her views on interracial relationships.
Oh, thank you. And first, I'm Miss Angelou.
Miss Angelou.
Yes, ma'am. I'm not Maya. I'm 62 years old. I have lived so long and tried so hard that a young woman like you or any other has no license to come up to me and call me by my first name. That's first. Also, because at the same time, I am your mother, I'm your auntie, I'm your teacher, I'm your professor. You see?
Yeah, it's a great moment.
Well, there's this moment where Alfre Woodard, the actress, is talking. She works with Maya Angelou directed one film down in the Delta. And she tells the story about how Maya was always aware of these relationships, the way you treat each other, this sense of respect. Would you talk a little bit about this moment? Because I think this really gave you an insight about how she conceived of the world and the way she interacted with people. It was about respect, deference. I mean, it was really incredible.
So this is historical. In a sense, black people coming out of slavery had to say, yes, ma'am, yes, sir. They were also called by their first names. Kizzy, Juna, come here. And then you have them naming their children Prince and Queen. And that was done because now when you call me, Queen, come here. Prince, come here. So there's a historical context here. Mm. Now, Maya Angelou's grandmother was very much disrespected by the poor whites that lived on the land that she owned. And they could call her Annie. And they could call her whatever they wanted to, but she had to say to them, Miss Elaine, Miss So-and-so. So ingrained in her is the idea that someone calling you by your first name is a sign of disrespect. And so she would not call people by their first name. Her housekeepers would be Mrs. Crisp. You would call people Miss Stucky. You would not call people Lydia or Brenda. She did not allow that. She did not allow. She called me most often Mrs. Wack. She always did that. And she really kind of curled when people would just refer to her as Maya, as if you know me, as if you're that. And it, I think it brought this vestige of what happened to her grandmother back to her. Mm. And so she respected everybody. And so on a set, she would call everybody Mr. This, Mr. That, and she would respect them, and she wanted you to.
I loved this moment from the film Alfred Woodard. Let me play this moment because she's talking about being on the set. And the other thing that's so interesting about it, and this was a big something that was really important for Maya Angelou, was this idea of how the South, and this seemed ironic because all of the terrible things that happened in the Jim Crow South, but that, as we'll hear from Alfred Woodard, there was a healing power in the land, in working the land, and that was important in the South. Here's another moment from the film.
Dr. Angelou believed in the beauty and the healing power of the South and of family and connection.
150 years of family history right here.
Just as important as the story that we were telling was how we treated ourselves and each other in the process of telling that story. And so she was called Dr. Angelou on the set, and she called people Miss Divine, even like a grip, just like a beer belly grip. We honored each other and honored this story. The whole crew would sit and she would talk about the historical significance of a particular scene and what would be happening in that space 100 years ago. It was like we were on an archaeological dig on sacred ground.
Alfred Woodard is amazing.
Yeah, she really is.
And that's from the film that Maya Angelou directed called Down in the Delta, which is a very good film, by the way. People should check it out. It's a great
I want to see it now.
It's great.
I never had really thought much about it, to be honest with you.
She pioneered so many things. I believe she was one of the first African-American women to be a member of the Directors Guild of America. Mm, so yeah. Among all her other things, there's that.
Bob Hercules is with us, Rita Coburn-Wack as well, co-directors of Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. The film is premiering next Tuesday here at the Sundance Film Festival. Additional screenings will happen throughout the week, and you can get details for all of that on our website, radiowest.org. The film is going to be seen and premiere on the PBS series American Masters coming this fall. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are live at the community radio station KPCW, As we continue our coverage of the 2016 Sundance Film Festival, we're talking with Rita Coburn-Wack and Bob Hercules about their film Maya Angelou and Still I Rise. The film premieres next Tuesday. There are screenings throughout the week. We'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. The film is going to premiere on the PBS series American Masters in the fall. I sort of would have figured that we knew everything there was about Maya Angelou throughout her life. But Bob Hercules, this is one thing you were mentioning off the air. You discovered a lot of things that most people probably don't know about her.
I mean, to be truthful, a lot of the material is in her books. She wrote, I think, seven autobiographical books. But these are stories that really weren't wide. One of the things we came across was this play by Jean Genet, The Blacks.
I love this part of the film, by the way.
It's fascinating. In 1961, Maya was involved in this amazing play, The Blacks, with this a cast that became all-star cast, but at the time were not well-known. Cicely Tyson, Lou Gossett, James Earl Jones, Godfrey Cambridge, Maya Angelou. So they did this play that performed off-Broadway in 1961. It actually had a long run. Maya was not in it for the full run, but she was in it in the beginning of the run. And
it's French playwright Jean Genet.
It's a very controversial play. A lot of people walked out of the theater. Well, there's a great story in there that one person was trying to get out of the theater so hard they broke their leg.
Right.
I mean, it was really a controversial play, and it was really about, as Lou Gossett says, it really is about this simple thing, which is racism is absurd, and that's the premise of the play.
So. She was really in the thick of it in Harlem, wasn't she? I mean, that she was absolutely, you know, she was in the Harlem Writers Guild. I mean, the foment and the conversations, that must have been extraordinary.
I think that one of the things that you see is her life is tracking American history and African-American history. So if you go from the Jim Crow South to St. Louis, you're going to the Great Migration area. And then you go out to San Francisco, and then you go to New York for the Harlem Writers Guild. You live some time in Cairo. You live some time in Ghana. You live some time in Hawaii. So you've actually documented history firsthand. And what we find is, here's a black woman, not where you get history from in the book, not that who's living it and documenting this kind of history. And so we pick up a lot of nuances in her life that have either become somewhat obscure or that maybe not fit into current popular culture. Yeah. So, but what you find is you find people like that young woman who thinks, I know her well enough to call her Maya because I read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Could there be any more than this? Yeah. And what they don't realize, there's six more books of that.
Right.
You know, who lives history gets actively involved in it and then documents it. So we had a wealth of information to work with.
I was surprised by the fact that she had deep friendships with both Dr. King and Malcolm X.
Yes.
Yeah. She's really one of the most unusual things is that very few people had that. The camps were very divided.
Yeah, you chose one or the other. Right. It seems so like she was able to. How did she manage that, do you think?
I think from a civil rights perspective, what Maya Angelou has really proven is that she was always somewhat ambidextrous. She could look and listen and see the good and the sense that one person made in what they were doing. And I think at the time when she met with Malcolm X, when he came to Ghana, she met him there and she got a chance to speak with him and to hear what his thoughts were. At the same time, nonviolence, and she says this, that she had been herself violated. And when Dr. King preached nonviolence, she felt that resonated with her.
Yeah.
And Jules Pfeiffer said this to us. During that period of time in the 60s, there were a lot of people who were going through this transition. This is right really before we got the Black is Beautiful and Black Power, who really thought that they could make a change. I think one of her things that we saw, she said this nation was going to birth a new baby and its name was freedom, like we were really going to become free. At that time, you're in New York and she's friends with Abby Lincoln and Max Roach. And Max Roach, of course, does the musical Freedom Suite. And people really thought, in this moment, I'm in my 20s, I'm in my 30s, we can change the world. And I think she was able to see these schools of thought from Martin Luther King and from Malcolm X and feel that they could change things.
Yeah. I really liked the moment, too, where she talks about how Malcolm X had the courage to see the new thing and say the new thing, that he was evolving in the way he thought. And I thought I think she really respected that. I thought that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. I want to play a moment from her son, Guy Johnson, who's terrific in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Every time he opens his mouth, he's amazing. He tells these amazing stories. And there's a beautiful kind of scary, really profound moment. And I wanted you to set this up for us, where they're protesting, and she is in the street, and she holds her ground while others move to the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. Maya Angelou, and she's there with her son, and she holds her ground. Do you want to say something about this moment?
Well, they were protesting the violence that had come down on the freedom riders, the people that had gone down south to ride and for voters' rights and equal rights. And so it was a tense protest in New York, and things got very, very tense. The policemen were, a lot of them were on horseback, which is very intimidating. And so they used that as a power to wedge the people out. And what they didn't realize is that they were encountering Maya Angelou. And so you'll hear the rest.
And we had about 400 people. Three blocks away, the mounted police pull into the street in formation. People in the demonstration began going to the sidewalk. Because in those days, they ran over people. They stomped them, trampled them, and left their bodies in the street. And I was looking at my mother, and she kept on. And I said, Ma, come on. You're going to get us killed. Let's go. She turned to me and she said, one person standing on the word of God is the majority. I looked at her and I thought, you would have gone crazy. By the time the police got to us, there was probably 8 or 9 people out of the 400 behind us. The sergeant in charge started to walk past us. My mother pulled out this big hairpin out of her headband and stuck it in the sergeant's horse. The sergeant's horse neighed, reared up. The sergeant fell off. The people came back from the sidewalk and we finished that march. Whew. And seeing courage like that brought right up to my face. She took me on a trip or two.
Yeah, I mean, Guy is, her son, Guy Johnson, is absolutely riveting, as you said, every time he's on screen.
He's amazing.
He just has this amazing ability to tell stories and to put himself
got it from
moment.
His mom.
Yes, he did.
It's
and he's
true.
Just like her, he's in the moment. He's there.
He really is.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We're running out of time. I don't want the time to go by before we hear Maya Angelou reading a poem, as she does in the documentary. She's talking about a poem that she wrote about a lady on the bus. Rita Coburn-Mack, would you set this up for us? Because it's such a lovely, heartbreaking poem.
It's a wonderful poem, and it's a poem in which Maya Angelou has been observing, which is one thing that she's done all of her life, been so observant. And she's observing a woman who gets on the bus every day and has a little laughter. And she realizes that that's the Black survival instinct, the same thing that got her through stamps, that got people in these places where they were uncomfortable and they had a nervous laughter to it. And she observed this woman to see what that really was, and she wrote about it. It also comes from Paul Laurence Dunbar's The Mask, her way of bringing that up to modern day time.
I have written a poem for a woman who rides a bus in New York City. She's a maid. She has 2 shopping bags. When the bus stops abruptly, she laughs. If the bus stops slowly, she laughs. I thought, Now, if you don't know Black features, you may think she's laughing. But she wasn't laughing. She was simply extending her lips and making a sound. I said, oh, I see. That's that survival apparatus. Now, let me write about that to honor this woman who helps us to survive. 70 years in these folks' world, the child I works for calls me girl. I say, yes, ma'am, for working sake. I'm too proud to bend and too poor to break. So I laugh until my stomach ache when I think about myself. My folks can make me split my side. I laugh so hard, I nearly died. The tales they tell sound just like lying. They grow the fruit but eat the rind. I laugh until I start to cry when I think about myself.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an amazing moment. It's it is one of those moments that you need to see as well as hear, though,
because absolutely. You
can see it on her face. There's tears streaming down. She's gone through an emotional ordeal by delivering the poem that's so clear on her face. It's so powerful. Even after watching that 100 times, I still get chills from watching
too.
That poem.
We're pretty much out of time. Rita Kober-Mack, would you say something finally? You know, one thing where you end the film is this idea of this new generation. What are they going to do without Maya Angelou's voice? Are you worried about that?
I think that that's what this film is about. And I think our outreach will be both to the usual suspects, the people who come for documentaries. We will do a lot of social media to bring younger people over to continue the legacy. What we realize that we're doing is we're working with history. And so history must always be continued. And when it comes from this perspective, it's very important to me personally. It's very important for us to see how this history is being documented.
Rita Kober-Mack and Bob Hercules, the co-directed Maya Angelou and Still I Rise, which premieres this Tuesday at the Sundance Film Festival. There are screenings on Wednesday and Friday and Saturday, and you can get the details at radiowest.org. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, Doug.
Thanks for having us.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Our thanks to KPCW Scott Matthews and Bob Hendricks, who directed the show. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.